welcome to Skagit Talks. Interviews with interesting people from Skagit Valley College, as well as folks from around the Skagit Valley. Now, Skagit Talks. Welcome to Skagit Talks. In the first half of our program, KSVR presents the Skagit Valley News from around the Skagit Valley as reported by Joanna Bruno. The second half of Skagit Talks will be our interview from the community and Skagit Valley College. Now, KSVR, Skagit Valley's community radio, presents the news.
Your health is pretty important to you and your loved ones, and donations to the American Heart Association may help you or someone you love in the future. To that end, Health Source Chiropractic and Progressive Rehab wants to help you start the new year off right by providing free community health screenings in exchange for a $10 donation to the American Heart Association. The health screening will be held Friday, February 26th, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. The screening will include blood pressure and body mass index, BMI, and will help track down even the smallest amount of pain you might experience. Donations will be accepted at the office in Stanwood until February 26th, but contributors are encouraged to call and set up an appointment. Heart disease, stroke, and other forms of cardiovascular disease remain the number one killer in the United States, taking the lives of far too many loved ones and friends each year. Donations will help offset the costs of medical research, which is leading to new ways to prevent, treat, and even cure heart disease and stroke. To schedule an appointment, call 360-629-4722 today. For more information, facts, or figures about cardiovascular health, go to AmericanHeart.org. Affordable health care is a major national issue, but is only one of the challenges facing lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, aka LGBT, people when it comes to their medical care. Too often, medical providers lack the basic cultural competency on LGBT issues, rely on misinformation, or simply do not have access to simple and effective resources, which creates barriers in adequate healthcare access for their LGBT patients. The release of Straight for Equality in Healthcare aims to change this trend. For many healthcare providers, it isn't a case of not wanting to be inclusive of GLBT patients, but rather a sense that it isn't an issue, or, when it is, confusion around how to talk about it that gets in the way, said Jody M. Huckabee, Executive Director of Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays National, also known as PFLAG, the organization that authored the new publication. Making the case for inclusive and competent health care for LGBT patients is critical, and by providing simple and accessible information to health care professionals, we can transform the experiences of LGBT people in the health care system, said Huckabee. This guide will create more effective relationships between straight health care providers and their lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender patients, and can radically improve healthcare for our community. Straight for Equality in Healthcare is the second publication from PFLAG's National Straight for Equality Project. The project, launched in 2007, aims to help people have the everyday non-political conversations that need to occur in order to foster greater acceptance of GLBT people. Since its inception, the project has trained more than 3,500 people nationwide on the topic of how to be a straight ally. The new Straight for Equality in Healthcare Guide was created with the assistance of a diverse committee of healthcare professionals in fields such as primary care, mental health, nursing, and allied health disciplines. The new publication is featured on the Straight for Equality in Healthcare website. The site includes broader discussions of the issue and additional resources. PFLAG is committed to making sure this publication gets into the right hands and makes a difference, said John R. Sipek, president of PFLAG National. In conjunction with this release, we are providing a project workbook to our more than 350 chapters across the country to help them put these resources into their providers' hands and have the conversation about equality in healthcare in our communities, concluded Sipek. It may surprise you to know that some of the biggest names in the history of snowboarding were from Mount Vernon. With the Winter Olympics in our backyard, you may be planning to watch snowboarding on TV. If you didn't know much about the sport, that is about to change. You can learn all about the origins and growth of this enormously popular winter sport on Sunday, February 28th at 2 p.m. The Skagit County Historical Museum will host Nicole Evans, Special Events Coordinator for the Mount Baker Ski Area. This Skagit Topics presentation, A History of Snowboarding in the Pacific Northwest, is scheduled in conjunction with the featured exhibit, The Way We Played, Early Skagit Recreation, and is included with the museum admission. The museum is located at the top of the hill in LeConnor. For more information, call 360-466-3365 or visit skagitcounty.net/museum. You may recall that last week we chatted with Senator Kevin Ranker about his shoreline bill. Senator Ranker feels it's only appropriate that Washington, with its 3,000 miles of shoreline, be in the vanguard of states in the management of its marine resources, and three bills passed by the Senate ensure that. Our Puget Sound and coast face an era of unprecedented activities, Senator Ranker, a Democrat from San Juan Island, said. Important existing uses and new proposals are competing for what once seemed like limitless space. In order to maximize the benefits of our sound and ocean provide, both ecologically and economically, we urgently need a process to rationally guide the multiple management objectives. This bill gets us there. Ranker's Senate Bill 6350, which passed 44-2, will allow all entities which depend on Washington's marine resources, such as fishing, aquaculture, shipping, recreation, and proposed wave, tidal, and other energy facilities, to make informed and coordinated decisions on the use of marine resources. Another Ranker bill, Senate Bill 6557, limits the use of copper in brake pads. A third, Senate Bill 6373, aligns the state with the Environmental Protection Agency's greenhouse gas reporting rule. Senate Bill 6557 would limit the amount of dissolved copper that enters Puget Sound. Close to 7 million metric tons of dissolved copper enter the sound every year, half of which originates from brake pads and is harmful to salmon and other marine resources on which we depend. This bill requires brake pads to be made of substances less detrimental to the environment. Senate Bill 6557 passed 39-8. We've found that the copper powder that comes off brake pads is a significant contributor to polluting the marine environment, Ranker said. We are fixing the pollution problem by working with the auto industry to keep motorists safe while protecting our waterways from copper. Senate Bill 6373 passed 45-1 and directs the Department of Ecology to adopt rules requiring people to report emissions of greenhouse gases where those emissions from a single facility, source, or site, or from fossil fuels sold in Washington by a single supplier meet or exceed 10,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide annually. This makes our state reporting standards consistent with our federal standards so that it is easier for the folks that have to report to do so, Ranker said. Nearly all his proposed bills have advanced out of committee. This is only the first of several steps, but it is a solid step in the right direction. These bills are important to our communities, and he plans to continue work tirelessly to get them to final passage. Washington State Department of Transportation will build two more roundabouts in Burlington this spring, bringing the total number of roundabouts in Skagit County up to 9, according to Dustin Turpening, spokesman for the Department of Transportation.
We've hired a local contractor from Burlington, Interwest Construction, to build several of our projects, one in Blaine, one in Burlington, And the one here in Burlington will actually rebuild the I-5 Chuckanut interchange. We're going to put in two roundabouts, one on either side of the interchange, as well as rebuild the northbound I-5 off-ramp and on-ramp to improve safety and relieve congestion at the interchange. Construction will start here in the spring and will hopefully wrap up sometime in the fall of this year.
WashDOT recently awarded the project to InterWest Construction Incorporated of Burlington for $4.8 million. This project is primarily funded by the 2005 Transportation Partnership funding package. Crews will build the single-lane roundabouts at the Josh Wilson Road and Old Highway 99 intersections on Chuckanut Drive. Crews will also improve the northbound I-5 on- and off-ramps by relocating the off-ramp south of the interchange and lengthening the on-ramp. Both of the I-5 on- and off-ramp intersections will connect with the roundabouts to help improve safety and relieve congestion at the interchange. In recent years, congestion and collisions have been a regular occurrence at the interchange. There were 91 collisions in the vicinity of the interchange from 2002 to 2006, in which 36 people were injured and one died. InterWest Construction Incorporated of Burlington has also been awarded a $2.8 million contract to build two new roundabouts at the I-5 D Street interchange in Blaine. Construction will begin after the Winter Olympics in British Columbia are finished.
The project in Blaine is very similar to the one here in Burlington. We're going to put two roundabouts in at an interchange in Blaine as well and make some modifications to I-5 to slow drivers down as they approach the border. And that project will have a similar timeline. The work will start in the spring and wrap up hopefully in the summer. InterWest Construction also got a bid to move a portion of Mount Baker Highway in Whatcom County away from the Nooksack River to help protect the road and drivers from the river when it rises in the fall and winter and threatens to flood. InterWest provided the most competitive bids, and they were the low bidder on the projects and actually came in quite a bit under our estimates. It's a very competitive market right now. Everybody's looking for work, and so we're seeing some great prices on projects. It's a great time to build construction projects.
The Blaine Safety and Traffic Flow Improvement Project is fully funded by the federal government and will complement improvements the General Service Administration made at the I-5 Peace Arch border crossing. InterWest construction crews will build two single-lane roundabouts, one at each on-off-ramp intersection, to improve traffic flow and safety at the interchange, and will make modifications to I-5 to help slow drivers down as they approach the border.
The money is from the federal government. It's for work near the border. And then the one here in Burlington is funded by the 2005 Transportation Partnership funding package. We got the money here in 2005, and so we've been designing the project, and then we'll go to construction this spring.
Impact for the Burlington project will affect drivers on North Burlington Boulevard and that freeway interchange, but shouldn't be too bad, Turpening said.
You know, as with any construction project, there are typically lane closures and stuff like that, so there will be some pain, but hopefully it won't be too bad.
InterWest Construction will provide local folks with jobs and other businesses in the area with work as well.
You know, it's projects like these that put local contractors to work, and they'll hire people from the local union halls, and they'll hire subcontractors, and, you know, it keeps our inspectors busy as well. So it should have a nice little impact on the local economy.
While it is true that many local drivers don't like roundabouts, they do save lives and manage traffic flow. Once you get used to them, you may find waiting at stoplights very aggravating, Turpening noted.
This project here in Burlington at the interchanges, you know, there were 91 collisions in the vicinity of that interchange between 2002 and 2006, and there were actually 36 people who were injured and one person died. So the work that we're doing there should help make some serious safety improvements. The lights, they can be a bit of a nuisance. And then the high school's got that roundabout right there, so we'll actually have three roundabouts in a row there on Burlington Boulevard / Chuckanut Drive.
Roundabouts may seem scary, but once you get used to them, you begin to see the benefits.
You know, we hear from people that say, yeah, I'm just going to avoid the roundabouts because I don't like them. The roundabouts, it's just so much less congestion. You don't have to stop. You just keep moving. You know, you put in enough of the roundabouts, and you get to the point where you get to a stoplight, and it's like, oh, why can't there be a roundabout here? Once these two roundabouts are built, it'll bring the total number of roundabouts in Skagit County up to 9. I don't think that compares anywhere near to the number of signals, but hey, we're growing and we're building.
You have been listening to KSVR 91.7 FM, news you'll want to know in Skagit Valley. I'm Joanna Bruno. Thanks for listening. And now, stay tuned for another special Skagit Talks interview.
Welcome to Skagit Talks. I'm Dave McConnell, your host today. We're going to talk about bamboo on this show. So what do you think of when you hear bamboo? An exotic Asian plant that doesn't do well in our valley? An invasive pest that can take over your whole yard or garden? A difficult plant that's only good for decoration? Well, we've invited a guest to the studio today to help us sort all this out. Jackie Heinricher, owner of Boo Shoot Gardens here in Mount Vernon. Welcome to Skagit Talks, Jackie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start with the basics. What is bamboo?
Well, bamboo is simply a grass, and there are a couple of forms of bamboo. One is what we consider a running form, and there is a non-invasive clumping form of bamboos, and there are about 1,200 species altogether.
And what's its native habitat? I think of it as being in Asia. Is that fair?
It is, but bamboos are found all over the world except for the two poles. So it's really a plant that grows worldwide. It's known from Asia because we mainly import all of our bamboo products from Asia.
I see. And you say was it native to North America? Is it native to North America?
It is, and I think that's a fact that most people don't understand. We have three species of bamboo native to the United States, and they're all the leptomorphic or running type bamboos, lepto meaning rabbit in Latin. We think of these plants as being incredibly invasive and difficult to tackle, but one of those bamboos, one of the native U.S. bamboos, occupied over 5 million acres less than 100 years ago and was completely wiped out by development and farming. So it's a very shallow-rooted group of plants. It's extremely easy to devastate those stands. And as a consequence, even though bamboos have been growing in the United States, even introduced bamboos since about 1800, there are no naturalized forests of bamboos in the United States.
Was that, you said there was 5 million acres in North America?
Yeah.
In this part of the country?
Yeah, along the Mississippi River. Not in Washington State, no. Though there are timber bamboos that grow very well here, but along the Mississippi drainage, all the way up into Ohio, and farther, potentially, there were folks hunting panther in bamboo stands along the Mississippi less than 60 years ago. So those were significant stands of bamboo.
But they're all gone now.
They're all gone. There are all patches left. And actually, we're in custody of the last material on some of those plants from Mississippi State University, and we're attempting to clone these plants for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to get into some restoration projects.
Okay, I want to get to that in a few minutes, but you say there is some growing here in the valley, some bamboo. Is it a viable plant here other than decorative?
Yeah, yes, there it is. My company has sort of pioneered two lines. One is the non-invasive bamboos, perfect for the backyard garden. They don't run. We call them bamboos that behave. But there are significant timber bamboos that are commercially very valuable that grow extremely well here. And here in Skagit Valley, they can grow to over 70 feet tall with very large canes. It just isn't something that had been entertained, and it hadn't been entertained as a forestry agriculture plant because there was really no scientific production method.
You say it's usable for construction.
It's usable for construction. The amount of engineered product today is fantastic. Everything from railroad ties to glue lamps to floor joists to plywood to flooring to T-shirts to so bamboos can make a lot of product out of one plant, and it's sustainable. So you can harvest a percentage of each acre annually, year after year after year, which is a very different prospect as a natural resource than, say, a stand of trees. It's not meant to replace that stand, but it's another natural resource that's viable and can produce a lot of product.
So it sounds almost too good to be true. Why don't we see it around then?
Again, the technology to actually produce these plants, if you look back through all the university studies dating back to the 60s, all of these studies point up the amount per acre that these plants produce, the value on the product side. But the footnote to every one of those studies is there's just no viable way to produce these plants. Bamboos flower once every approximately 100 years. So unlike a tree resource, we can't grow them from seed. So there's just, up until about 2007, really there wasn't the cloning technology to utilize this plant in any significant term.
And, of course, that brings us to Bouchut Gardens. You clone bamboo plants there. Is that my understanding
correct?
That's
right, yeah.
And how does that work? How does cloning plants work?
Well, so I have a tissue culture lab, plant tissue culture lab. Plant tissue culture is utilized here in the valley for raspberries, potatoes, cabbage, cauliflower. It's used on trees and flowers. We took that approach with bamboos, knowing we couldn't produce them in numbers in any other way. And so it's basically a way to take a plant and give it the right building blocks to compel it to reproduce itself. In other words, shoot in the case of bamboo. So you're actually producing multiple plants in a test tube. It's really a fairly straightforward process with a complex set of building blocks.
And you say this has really only been around for 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, my company's been in research and development on this process for over 9 years. Labs around the world have been working with bamboo for over 30 years. And we've been really the first lab in the world to crack the code in a significant way.
So it's not just a matter of taking a plant and cutting it in half and you've got two plants.
No, and if you look at bamboos worldwide, they're really in peril. They're being over-harvested. The natural resource, the demand for raw material has increased. The pricing for raw material in China has increased almost 600% in the last couple years. There's no sustainable harvest. These forests are in peril. So like any natural resource, we have to find a way to be able to reforest, and it's through this type of cloning technology that's going to happen with bamboos. So
cloning almost sounds sort of science fiction-y to a lot of us, but it's a fairly straightforward process once you get it started, right?
Yeah, it's really, some would argue that the first clone of bamboo was done with a spade. And so essentially you're just creating a multiplication process. You're really not going through the genetic science of cloning the, quote, embryonic state. So you're really kind of finding the right building blocks, the right set of sugars and hormones and all these things that help the plant to inspire it to send up new growth.
So what you've got is more shoots of the same plant.
Correct.
Is that a fair kind of way to look at it?
Yeah, let's just pretend we're looking into a test tube, and we have one sole singular plant in that test tube. And if you have the right building blocks in that test tube where that plant's sitting, for instance, it's sitting in a media or auger, it's almost looks like Jell-O. 4 weeks later, that tube will have about 10 plants. It'll have multiple plants. So those shoots come up from the bottom like it might underground. It works a similar way. And so all of a sudden you have a tube that's much fuller. And then you don't have one plant, you have 10.
Okay, so when you say tube, are you talking about test tube size?
Yep, exactly.
So you've got 10 plants. Now, if I remember my high school chemistry class, a test tube is about as big around as my index finger. How do you get 10 plants out of that?
Yeah, well, you're dealing with small materials, so. But you're right, it's a small test tube. These are probably a little bit bigger than what you remember from, say, a high school chemistry lab.
That was a long time ago, so yeah. That's not surprising.
Well, you know, surprisingly, we still employ much of the same equipment, so. No, it's a real familiar type of process. But yes, and then what we do is we break those up, and now we have 10 new tubes, and then those fill out and so on and so forth. And we start to build up these fairly massive banks of tubes, in other words, tube numbers.
Sounds like a fairly labor-intensive process.
It is. It is very labor intensive. It's highly technical. Bamboos are probably the most difficult group of plants to do in tissue culture. Every species is a different, was a different issue. I mean, we had to kind of figure it out for each of the species that we worked on. And we're still working on species. We're doing about 50 at this point. So it is labor intensive. Our lab has about, 32 people that actually sit and work with these test tubes. So.
It almost sounds like they almost have to work with microscopes to see this stuff, or a magnification of maybe just my eyes, but that's what it seems like to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're probably about, each plant's about 2 inches tall. And so, you know, it's totally visible. It's a visible process. You don't need that kind of magnification to work with these. So,
but it's a fairly involved process, nevertheless, of somebody sitting down and separating these 10 plants out and planting them in another test tube, and then you've got 10 more, and you keep doing this for as long as you can.
Exactly, it goes on and on, and it is. It is a labor. It's a complex, labor-intensive process. It's very highly technical. We actually get quite a few classes, college groups that come in and look at the lab. We do a kind of a demo of what we do, and so it's fascinating.
It sounds fascinating. Where did your interest in this come from?
I'm a scientist by graduate training. I really worked in fisheries for a period of time in Tennessee, but I come to love bamboo by way of my childhood. My father had bamboos in our gardens from the time I can remember. My memories from the time I was very small are of playing in bamboo. And I've always had a fascination of, in fact, my first brownie project, I planted a bamboo.
I see.
It's been a lifelong love, and I finally decided to turn that love, that passion, into a scientific endeavor.
And a business.
And a business.
Yes. Well, it's clear that there's a lot more to bamboo than I often think or we often think of. It's a very complex and involved sort of thing. I've been talking with Jackie Heinricher, owner of Boo Shoot Gardens here in Mount Vernon, about bamboo and what goes on and how it works and so forth. Jackie, thanks for coming by and sharing this information with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
This is Dave McConnell signing off for Skagit Talks.
Skagit Talks was produced by Joseph C. McGuire and engineered by Jay Charles. Tune in next time for more Skagit Talks.